A dairy farmer turned senator hoping to turn governor talks education. Matt's mom talks about Canada, eh? An astrophysicist and even Alfie Cohn. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From Madison.com, lawmakers tackle changes to funding Wisconsin schools. Lawmakers and school officials across Wisconsin are looking at big and small ways to change how the state funds schools, a system created 4 decades ago.
Wow.
That's a long time.
40 years.
They haven't changed it in 40 years.
We have not changed how we fund schools in 40 years in the state of Wisconsin. It's due for a change.
They've been doing bake sales for 40 years.
They've been doing bake sales. Hey, funding public schools is actually a really big question in not just in Wisconsin, but across the country. How do we do it? Okay, the first thing is to understand is that mostly it's real estate and property owners where through those taxes, that's how you fund your schools. Mm-hmm. And then there's a contribution by the state, and then there's a contribution by the federal government.
Okay? Right.
The question here is, though, well, if that's the formula, why do we need to change it? Because if you start using real estate property owners, some schools then will get more money, which is the opposite of a public school system committed to all children in the state getting equity in the education they receive. So we actually have this problem. There are districts in Wisconsin where the per pupil spending is about $4,000. There's a difference of about $4,000 to $5,000
per kid.
Okay. In the state of Wisconsin. And so we need to, according to this article and according to some of the legislators here, come up with a better formula. However, nothing in this article tells us what you were talking about.
No, I was reading through this and it's like, okay, it's the first serious review in 20 years. 20 years, that's a long time. They should probably look at this. Things change. And then it goes down and it says, well, it could be improved, but they don't need an overhaul.
Right.
But we should look at it, but we don't need to change things.
Okay.
I didn't see any answers in this.
And that's my whole problem with this right now, because what you've just pointed out, Bonnie, is exactly what's going to happen. This is a political tug of war.
Mm-hmm.
And so it reads like a political tug of war right away because
it really does.
It needs changing. No, it doesn't need to be changed. We need to tinker with this.
No,
I need to
fine.
Put it back on the shelf. No, we don't want it to collect dust on the shelf. We want it to be real. This is the problem with politicians. Okay? They're looking at this from ways to win. Now, granted, they're going to call this a blue ribbon panel. Besides politicians, there are some superintendents on this commission. There is a past dean of a school of education on this commission. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's my problem with it. First of all, the commission itself, from the political standpoint, is already stacked with a majority of people who actually don't really care for public schools. So I got a problem right there off the bat telling me that, look, you're not serious and you're actually going to find ways probably to defund public schools.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is though, how can you have a blue ribbon commission about funding schools and you don't have a single teacher or a parent on the blue ribbon committee?
I guess you only got a red in that category.
Okay. So, you know what? The article, the topsy-turviness and back and forth in this, and I'm saying this here in Wisconsin. First of all, yes, we have a funding problem.
Yes.
Admit it. We don't need a effing blue ribbon panel. What we need is the ability and to admit that if we have a disproportionate of like $4,000 to $5,000 across the state between students, we need to figure out how that works. There are lots of indicators, though. Do certain kids need certain transportation needs? What are the costs in rural areas versus urban areas? What is the cost for students living in poverty versus students not living in poverty? We do need to overhaul the system so that equity is what drives our funding, not politicians.
Time for Tim to rant. This is Someone Has to Say It.
You know what? No ranting today. How about a little story instead? I call this Small Town School Boards 101. A few years back when I lived in that unique space between Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, that would be Pennsyltucky, an opportunity to serve on the local school board presented itself to me. Two of our board members stepped down, creating temporary vacancies. A call went out to the local community for volunteers. I got a little nudging from some of my, quote, friends, but I made the decision to put my name in pretty much on my own. You know, I like to walk the walk and talk the talk. But check it out. The process for replacing board members that step down is relatively simple. You submit your name and resume and explain your desire to be considered. You then appear in front of the current board and answer some school board related questions. If the current members find you acceptable and they vote for you, you're in. So I completed all the necessary paperwork. I received confirmation that I would be considered as a candidate. The following week, while walking through the elementary school and dropping some papers off for my daughter, I even got stopped in the hallway. According to this person, there was a lot of people in the community supporting me. Now, this term was only going to be for 4 months until the general election, and considering my background as an educator, I felt relatively confident in my chances of being selected by the remaining board members. However, 1 week before the interviews, I was informed by a friend that I was not going to be selected. How could that be? I hadn't even had my interview, I thought. The current board didn't really know anything about me, except for what was on my resume. Or so I thought. I pressed my friend for information. Why? What's the problem? How is it possible to be eliminated before I even interview? That's when living in a small conservative town smacked me upside the head. According to my friend, even though some community members liked my background in education, I had a major problem. You see, according to some in the community, although I was involved with Little League, football, and PTO, I was also, quote, a liberal college professor, most likely an atheist, and probably had plans to get rid of the Christmas play. I looked at my friend in disbelief. He then told me how he tried to defend me for over an hour, but they just weren't hearing it. Look, in truly conservative towns, right-wing rhetoric is typically viewed as unbiased news, absolutely factual. Therefore, since I actually did work at a college as a faculty member, I had to be an unabashed liberal, atheist, and Christmas warmonger. Anyway, after pondering this new professional reputation, I attended the interview process anyway. I gave great answers related to the public schools and what's best for children and communities that value public education. I kept my disdain for Christmas to myself. But in the end, I only received one of four votes needed to be selected to finish out the terms of the vacating school board members. Oh, well, it wasn't like I didn't have enough to do at my university job, you know, advocating for socialism and the destruction of all religions. However, after a month, I received a strange call one morning from a standing board member. This was a no vote for me. He told me that he had just filed his paperwork for re-election and found out that I wasn't running. He wondered why. I told him very simply that since my, quote, interview with the board and finding out my reputation in the community, I wasn't going to run in the election. I told him I didn't stand a chance at winning. Then it happened again, small town politics. According to this person, he now wished that he had voted for me and that, quote, other community members were hoping that I was going to run. I just listened and thought, really? What about Christmas?
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
According to an article she wrote for the Washington Post, Matt Damon's mom has been talking education in Nova Scotia. I wonder what she thinks about what they're doing up there.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
Nancy, Nova Scotia and early childhood education, they're doing some good stuff up there.
Yeah, I just took a trip up to Nova Scotia and learned a lot of things about early childhood education in Canada. And Nova Scotia is one of the many provinces, but they're actually all doing similar things. And it was stunning and shocking and even jolting experience for me because they were so on track with how, in my perfect world, you would approach early childhood education.
So they read your books.
Yeah, I think there are, you know what? There are many early childhood educators all over the world who know a lot about how to approach effective and creative and caring work with young children. And in fact, there are many in the United States, but they've been silenced by these absurd policies that have been mandated now since No Child Left Behind.
So what is it, though? I mean, what did you see? Give us some examples of something where you went, you said stunned and shocked. Those are interesting words to describe a positive experience with early childhood.
It was coming from a U.S. point of view.
Okay.
That was so stunning. But I was at a three-day conference, and what was so amazing was the conference was led by early childhood educators and early childhood professionals. And I could see that these were the people who were in charge of creating policies in Canada. And so the biggest contrast to me was having experienced in the U.S. almost no voice from early childhood educators when it came to the Common Core, and then spinning out from that many pre-K standards, all of which have been written in the same vein as the Common Core kindergarten standards were written. And they didn't ever come from the early childhood professional community. And so they never represented the voices of early childhood professionals and what they know about young children's development and learning. So that was a huge contrast, because there it was the early childhood community of professionals who were creating these things.
Okay, so that is, as you just said, not just from an early childhood point of view in the United States, the whole idea that any, quote, educator might have any sense of being part of making decisions that affect what's going on in the classroom is, it would be stunning and shocking to see it happening here in America in a public school.
Yeah, and teachers in general in the U.S., you know, feel that they've been silenced. They haven't had a voice. We hear that all the time from teachers. What's more egregious in the early childhood field is that having standards and expectations and one-size-fits-all kinds of, mandates for younger children is even more harmful and inappropriate than it is for learners of any other age. You know, if you don't pay attention to child development issues with younger kids, you're getting into a danger zone of harming them.
So one great observation vignette that you saw in Nova Scotia that makes us go, now that's early childhood.
Well, because I was talking with teachers. I wasn't actually in classrooms.
One teacher comment that made you go, yes.
Oh boy, there were quite a few. I can't think of one specific comment, but mostly people saying things like, this is our document. They were presenting a framework for how they're approaching early childhood. And they were saying to the other early childhood people, there are hundreds of people here, this is our document. We're going to develop this over time through a process. We have many groups participating in this. We're holding focus groups. We're having dialogues, pilots. You try these things out. You meet with us to talk about how it's working out, and we'll keep evolving this document so that it represents what you all value and understand about the professional work you do.
And there wasn't one politician there saying, but this, if you put that in there, I won't get any votes.
There wasn't a politician there.
Oh.
Because these people are telling the politicians what they're doing. It's a complete reverse of what we see here. And, it's driven by the education community, as opposed to here driven by politicians and edging out the professional voices of educators.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
She's a dairy farmer. She was a college professor. She's the state senator from Wisconsin's 31st district. She is Kathleen Vinehout. She is running for governor. Welcome to Busted Pencils.
Hey, thanks. It's great to be here.
Governor? What are you running out of cows?
Well, let me tell you, I kept my boots when I got done milking cows because I didn't really think I'd need them, but boy, have I needed them a lot in medicine.
Okay. So a little walking around in a little bit of dirt.
A little bit more dirt.
Now, Kathleen, thanks for being on the show, but running for governor, and we're going to talk a lot about education. In fact, right hot off the presses here, we're looking at Wisconsin, this blue ribbon panel to look at inequitable or equitable or how to fix the funding that we have a problem. And I want to point this out, that it was pointed out that in some of the districts, for example, that people who believe the funding is fine, their constituents are getting well over $2,000 more than kids in Milwaukee, but would say that we don't have a funding problem in Wisconsin. You think we do have a funding problem in Wisconsin?
Absolutely.
Okay, so what do we do?
Well, I guess the first step is to agree on the problem. And as you suggested, a lot of folks don't agree on the problem, or they don't see what's going on as a problem. One of the big issues we have is equity, that there's a big difference between the ability of one school district to deliver a quality education and the ability of another. And whether we're talking about inside in the inner cities or we're talking about the rural areas, mm-hmm. we've got a real inequity or a lack of fairness in the way students are educated and the opportunities that those students have.
And one of the ways it's easy to break this down, because it gets really complex, is we talk about per student funding, right? And that's a way to give people an anchor. And so we might say that a student gets $7,000 a year for funding. And somebody would say, well, then you have a public education system, so then it makes sense that across the state of Wisconsin, every student, if we were doing it equally, would get $7,000. Okay. We're not talking, though, about equally, and even that is problematic in and of itself, because you're throwing in the word equitable. What's the difference?
I would say that right now, we want approximately the same opportunity for every child, regardless of where that child lives. And that approximately is kind of a term that reflects the way our state of Wisconsin Constitution was written, that each student has the opportunity to have an education that's about the same, and, mm-hmm. and the Constitution uses kind of a similar word.
Right. And this is the thing that people get thrown off by, is equity and equality, and they're not the same, because when we look at equity, the fact is that we have to look at the starting point.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
You know, and so when we talk about school funding and we talk about students, we have to look at where they start.
Absolutely.
To make that decision. And so when I see this blue ribbon panel here, I'm hopefully imagining that the first thing that you all can do is recognize if they're not starting in the same place. That creates an inequity right away. So then the funding formula does get to be complex if we're going to address this.
If you think about what happens in a community is reflected in the beautiful faces that you have in the kindergarten, what we see is the needs of those students coming to school are changing rapidly. And the difference in many school districts between the 12th graders and the kindergarten, that time period, you see the children are more likely to be children of color. They're more likely to be in poverty. They're more likely to need special services. All of these factors make a difference in what resources that child has if everybody gets exactly the same amount. And what the funding formula doesn't adequately allow for is that different kids have different needs.
Okay.
And different school districts have different needs. So if you take the district itself, I'm thinking about a very sparsely populated rural district has much higher transportation costs. In my world, we live in the beautiful hills of western Wisconsin, and the bus route kind of looks like a daisy. You go up the Cooley Road and down the Cooley Road and up the Cooley Road and down the Cooley Road. And all of that extra traveling up the valley and down the valley makes for a very long bus ride. So, for example, when my child was going to public school, his ride was an hour and 20 minutes. Now the rides have been consolidated in our school district, so they're even longer than that, just one way just to get the kid home at night. So that's a very different experience than a community that has the resources and is all in a very compact geographic area. But whether you're talking about an urban school district or a rural school district, the kids in the elementary schools look differently. Just a little example, in Arcadia in western Wisconsin, 75% of the children who are in the primary grades do not speak English as their mother tongue. They most of them speak Spanish at home. This means that it costs more to educate that child because the child needs additional help learning English. Even if the child's very, very smart, mm-hmm. that child still needs help mastering the language, and that takes more staff resources. That takes more curriculum. That curricular resources, that means that that school district needs to have an extra infusion of cash. And right now, the state isn't adequately addressing the needs of the different students across the state.
So just recognizing that right away, the inadequacy across, and as you just said, we can have this as a simple understanding of all kids are not the same. All kids start at different places, and then the geographic location of districts and the transportation costs. Why is this concept, though, so hard to understand in the political realm? Because you just explained it to us so that we all get it. Yes, certain schools, certain kids should have certain amounts of money based on the needs that they have. Why is this so hard to get in Madison? At the Capitol. Why do you have to wear boots when we go? Why do I need rubber boots when we talk about this?
Well, I guess the simple answer is probably that different people have different agendas, and it's very easy to get mired in the details of the vagaries of the formula, the history of the formula. I noticed sitting through the 4-some-hour hearing last week of this new Blue Ribbon Commission on School Funding, I noticed that we spent a great deal of time in the vagaries of the policy as it exists, but really didn't spend much time capturing what the problem is for the students, for the parents, for the school district, for the school board, for the community. That experience just wasn't present at the hearing the public hearing that we had. And I'm hopeful that the co-chairs, both of whom are Republican, are going to be true to their word and take this on this hearing, public hearing process on the road, so that we get to have public hearings in communities all around the state to hear from communities and parents and teachers and school board members what's really going on in their community. Because until we get a good definition of the problem, I don't think we're going to come up with a solution that's going to work.
We're talking to Senator Kathleen Vinehout. She's running for governor in the state of Wisconsin. We're talking about the inequities of school funding and particularly the big problem. What more do you have to say? I mean, what is the problem? And I know you said you want to go around the state, and this is great to hear from other people. But if somebody said, Kathleen, what's the problem with the school funding formula in Wisconsin?
Part of the problem is that there's a mismatch between the way the school has to pay out costs or their expenses and how the school gets paid. So if you think of the way the state pays the schools, the state pays on a per pupil basis. But if you think about the bills that the school has, a lot of the bills that the school has don't change when the number of students change. It's what we, if you think about it from business perspective, what we call fixed costs. They're all this to turn on the lights or to heat the building. That's a certain amount of money that they're going to pay no matter what, whether you have 12 kids in a class or 35 kids in a class. And oftentimes, as the school loses students, so rural schools, not as much population, people aren't having as many babies, and the schools are losing population. The schools are losing money from that by losing population, losing that per pupil payment much faster than they can cut costs. So what's happened is they've had to go back to the community and say, Madison, the capital, folks at the state capital, they're not giving us any more money. So we're going to have to consolidate. We're going to have to drop football. We're going to have to do something that you're not really going to like at all. So why don't you taxpayers pony up and help us pass referenda? People want their schools. Schools are the heart of the community over and over again across Wisconsin. Communities have stepped up and said, we're going to pass that referendum. We're going to raise our property taxes. We're going to put more money into our schools. We just had a couple years ago in Alma a 38% increase in our school portion of our property tax because the boiler went out and the kids had to have heat. What happens then is that a lot of people are paying a lot more in property taxes, and slowly over time, as all these referenda have passed, property taxes have been going up and going up and going up, and we've got a governor running to keep those property taxes low, as that governor is not keeping up the state part of the aid. Two don't fit together.
Okay, so there we go, right? You know, we want to keep taxes low, but we want to defund schools. Those two don't work out together.
They don't match. It's kind of like a teeter-totter.
Yeah.
As you cut the state aid, property taxes go up. If you want to fix the problem, you got to put in more state aid. That'll drive down property taxes. Amazingly, that happened under a Republican governor in the 1990s. Was Tommy Thompson put $1 billion into school aid and saw property taxes 2 years in a row drop substantially.
Well, we can talk more and more about funding as this campaign goes on. I want to jump quickly to another topic, though, as we move forward here. There's been discussion about Act 10 and the teacher shortage, whether they're connected, whether they are not connected. I'm wondering whether you see those two as a connected issue. If not, if why not? If so, how do you see this? And just the teacher shortage itself, what should we be doing?
Absolutely, they are connected. And it's very important that this Blue Ribbon Commission recognize the problems created by Act 10. Whole lot of problems. When the governor dropped the bomb on teachers and took away collective bargaining, a lot of teachers left. They retired. They took other jobs. College students aren't going into education as much as they were, which means a shortage. Morale is very low among teachers. Because of the great big deep cuts to schools, opportunities are being lost to students. All of this creates much harder job for school boards to find teachers to fill positions. And unfortunately, the legislature and the governor have reacted by lowering standards. That is not the way to solve the problem.
How do we solve it?
Well, we think about why you'd take a job. You take a job because you're respected, because you felt like you had the opportunity to do good work and use your talents, and you were paid well. That's how we bring teachers back into the field. When we look at the future, when we look at the 21st century economy, where we need to be going in the future, we need to educate our kids to take jobs that we can't even imagine right now. And to do that, we need education to be exciting, challenging. We need teachers to be innovators, to be at the top of their game, the top of their field. We need to professionalize teachers more than they are now, not less. And we need to bring down those walls, those regulations, those rules, that intense focus on testing. Get rid of what's stopping teachers from being innovative, and allow teachers to think about the future and the challenges those students are going to need. They're going to be facing, and get them the skills they need right now in our classrooms all across the state.
So you shifted into the classrooms there from Act 10, say, okay, yes, Act 10's created a condition in which teachers don't want to go into the field. They're leaving the field. But then in the classroom in itself, And because I was going to ask you about this. I mean, what about the conditions in the classroom? Testing for sure, right? Things that are driving, things that we have control of. You know, we make a conscious decision to focus on certain things. Right now, we focus on test scores. It's been Busted Pencil's position for 4 years now that that is the most stupid focus we can ever have. I think I heard the governor candidate, Kathleen Vineout, saying, you agree with me.
Absolutely, I agree with you. Think about it. When is a student, once they get out of school, ever going to be challenged in their job situation to sit down and take a pencil and paper test? I just can't imagine very many circumstances. But what that student is going to be challenged to do is to learn skills like cooperation, like conflict resolution, like working in groups, working on projects, working in an area where we can't even imagine what challenges they're going to be facing. It'll be so new, so different, and yet we're educating our students to be really good at picking out the right multiple choice answer. Those are not the skills we need to educate our students for in a 21st century economy.
So then as a potential future governor, I mean, think about this. Can we shift away from this testing obsession? I even talk about the money that we spend on this. So under a Vineout administration, will we move towards those more real, authentic learning situations and get away from the high-stakes testing and accountability that really doesn't serve the purpose of learning? Is that something that people in Wisconsin can look forward to?
Absolutely. I can see how we can break down the silos in our classrooms so that we're not just learning math, but we're learning math in the context of how we build that bridge, of how we create that study that helps us learn about how we fix schools or how we fix climate change or how we fix all of the problems that we're facing in our world today. And it's a very different kind of learning environment if we think, let's think about who we're accountable to. If we think we're accountable to the community, we're accountable to the folks that elected those folks on the school board, we're accountable to make sure that the students have the skills they need for that future job or to start that new business. This is a very different approach than saying we're going to follow what the testing organizations think are the most important thing those students need to learn. And some testing organization that's headquartered in another state that doesn't even know our communities from Mequon to Mondovi. That's why we have local school boards. That's why we have local people who are still saying, hey, these are the kind of jobs that students from our community are going to take. These are the kind of skills that they need to learn.
Take a break.
Lots of good ideas.
So many good ideas. Put it this way. So, Senator Vineout, as you go forward, if I want to support the campaign, where should I go?
Well, thank you for asking that. I would suggest that you like us on Facebook.
Okay.
That you come to our website, which is KathleenVineout.org. I would ask you to volunteer or choose to donate to the campaign. What I'm finding is that people are really, really excited about this campaign. And partly it's because I very much want to run a campaign where we put people first. My entire focus in policy as state senator over the years has to be put people first when it comes to state priorities, when it comes to state budgets. But also, I believe strongly that we need to put people first when it comes to campaigns. And that means building on local wisdom, helping people become empowered in their own community so they're talking to their friends, not running a top-down campaign from Boston or Washington or wherever the consultants are, but instead saying local people know how to talk to their neighbors about what's important to them. The wisdom is in the local neighborhoods and local communities, and I want to build on that wisdom in our campaign. So I encourage people to get involved. It's time for a different kind of governor. It's time for a different kind of candidate.
Facebook and website. And as we say here, Kathleen Vineout, thanks for busting pencils.
My pleasure.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
Time to enter the Cone Zone with education author and activist Elfie Cone on Busted Pencils.
All right, Elfie, we've heard so much over the years about cooperative learning. First of all, cooperative learning, what is it? But then, even more so, how does it contribute to a caring community?
In the best classrooms that I have spent time in, most of the time, kids are in pairs or small groups learning with and from one another. They spend some time doing stuff on their own, and they spend some time as a whole class, hopefully more discussing than listening. But most of the time is about the give and take of ideas. And we have a remarkably large and impressive research literature by now over the last four decades showing that cooperative learning, when kids are learning together, when it's done well, helps kids to feel better about themselves, to feel better about one another, to feel more excited about learning, and to learn better. You're pulled to a more sophisticated understanding of ideas when you are explaining them to others or listening to an explanation from one of your peers. It is truly breathtaking to watch, and it contributes to that broader social and moral goal, not just intellectual goal, of that caring community you mentioned, which is critical for helping kids connect with one another and feel part of an us. Cooperative learning, I mean, I've been working on this field and watching it grow since the 80s, and it's just, as long, again, I have to keep adding that caveat, as long as it's not turned into what one writer called hamburger helper, where you just give kids the same crappy worksheets to do, but then say, do this as a team.
Do this as a team, or the other criticism is, I've heard, though, too, is that, what do you mean cooperative learning? You mean cheating. They're cheating off of each other.
Well, isn't that amazing? I mean, we talk about how kids in the workplace and as citizens need to be able to share with one another to help. We want them to do that, but if they turn to one another and do stuff together in the way that turns out to be most effective for everyone concerned, we call that cheating. I want to see what you can do, not what your neighbor can do, as elementary school teachers said to me, you know.
Right.
Why don't you want to see what the greater capacity we have when we join together? I don't understand. We have to overcome the ideological commitment to self-sufficiency and individualism in this country in order to be able to not only permit but actively encourage and help kids to acquire the capacity for interaction, not just independence, but interdependence. And kids at high, medium, and low academic abilities all tend to benefit when this is set up right. And I, needless to say, good cooperative learning involves no grades, no points, no prizes, no competition between groups. That stuff will spoil this immediately.
Well, and then so add to that, then, as you said, this cooperative group then in the sharing in the caring community, because what I've also seen sometimes is that when we're going to talk about community, that's a separate lesson in and of itself, as opposed to what it sounds like you're talking about is that cooperative learning itself creates a caring community.
Yes, and conversely, a caring community enables and facilitates the creation of more effective cooperative learning pairs and groups. David and Roger Johnson at the University of Minnesota like to say, no one gets left out of a pair. So that even if you're having a class meeting to make decisions about how we want to organize the furniture in our room or where we'll take a field trip, not every kid's going to want to speak out. But if you say, turn to a partner and share some thoughts before we report back to the whole group, it elicits from kids who are shy and those who are not shy. It helps kids to feel connected to others, and that helps when it's time to sit and do cooperative learning and social studies. And by the way, I just wrote a piece about this issue. It's never necessary to push kids to reach a premature consensus. Like, I want all four of you to agree with whether the author makes a good point in this essay or not. Some kids are going to disagree. Nor is it necessary ever to have kids debate, you know, where the point is not to understand and learn, but to win. That's what debates are about, sorting kids into winners and losers. So there's this third way that cooperative learning specialists have been talking about for years, which has been called constructive controversy or cooperative conflict, where people hash things out and they do disagree, but in an atmosphere, in a climate that's really about caring. And that is not only much more pleasant for kids, it also facilitates deeper kinds of understanding of ideas.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
In a couple of weeks, we will be joined for a longer segment from astrophysicist Ethan Siegel, who has some incredible insights on education. Here is a little teaser with his take on that famous Alfie Cohn question. Ethan, what are the schools our children deserve?
When you talk about what schools our children deserve, I can't help but think of the huge diversity of needs that children have, of the different levels they have, and of the different ambitions they have. What a child needs in school is something that will provide them with a safe environment where they can learn, where they can explore, and where they can be curious. What that means is individualized attention. It means a teacher that can pay attention to where a student is, can accurately assess where can we get this student to in the time that we have to work with them, and what steps can I take to help them get there for themselves. So what a successful education looks at, like what a school a child deserves looks like, is a school where the teachers are free to give the children an education to the best of their abilities, where individualized attention is a thing, where separate tracks are needed perhaps for the gifted students, for students who need remediation, for students who are special ed or special needs, that you can give the students the educational experience they need that's tailored to their level, to where they are now, and where the teacher gets to decide to the best of their abilities. Because when it comes to education, that teacher is the expert, not a parent, not an administrator, and certainly not a legislator. That's the schools our children need, a school that has safe and quality facilities, where the children have everything they need to prepare themselves to be in an environment where they can learn, and where teachers are empowered to do the best job they can do to the best of their ability.
Time now for our weekly salute to historian and activist Howard Zinn. Here is your moment of Zinn.
It is possible, reading standard histories, to forget half the population of the country. The explorers were men, the landholders and merchants, men, the political leaders, men, the military figures, men. The very invisibility of women, the overlooking of women, is a sign of their submerged status.
Wow, what a packed show. My thanks to Matt's mom, Alfie Cohn, Kathleen Weinhout, and Ethan Siegel. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for Busting Pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio. We'll be right back.